Oh, I thank you so much for that blessing. I'm still vibrating. And I'm now questioning, what on earth could I add to this morning beyond that prayer, beyond this gathering? And I know I'm speaking to a whole room full of peacemakers. And, this is more of a challenge than I expected. And I fretted about this. I really wondered, why am I being asked to talk? And I realized after a time that it's because I'm a lover of dialogue. And that this is a total paradox, that I'm up here in a monologue. But your reputation as a group preceded you. Ann Howard arrived after her talk, and she said, that group is amazing. They've been in dialogue for 25 years. So I'm going to be sharing a little perspective from my experiences and the kinds of gifts that have bubbled up as I have held this invitation and looked out at the world and wondered, what on earth am I going to say? And I'll share those gifts with you. But what I'm looking forward to most is that opportunity to engage a little bit in dialogue. To me, one of the most amazing things that happens and I experience on a weekly basis at Just Faith is you begin to touch the value and the preciousness of our uniqueness and our individual perspectives. And when those get shared, as you've been doing so in this group, there's something that happens and you begin to have a fuller picture, a broader picture, a deeper picture, and it moves into that realm of holy. And that's what I love about dialogue. So I will live with this paradox, but not necessarily comfortably. Certainly one of the first gifts was Michael Cosby's book. I've dog-eared it. I have all these good intentions of going back and kind of taking notes. And so I end up with a shelf full of dog-eared books that I don't necessarily get back to. But you can see from the number of dog-ears that I found this truly valuable and gifted book. I had to laugh as he moved into the realm of theology, because that's not what I relate to too easily, and I managed to skip over all Greek words. But, you know, what kernels there were there. And one of the things that he mentioned very early on was Pax Romana. And one of those things, I'm an avid reader, and I'm currently in a book called The Search for Paul by John Dominic Croson and Jonathan Reed. And what they do is they take an archaeological look, as well as a theological look, at what was life at the time of Paul. And it was close enough to project slightly backward to what was real in the life of Jesus. One of the things that Cosby points out is that Pax Romana was a tranquility of order. And one of the things that Croson and Reed point out is that it was welcomed, that there was a long period of peace in an area that had known a lot of civil war, known a lot of strife. And the rules were clear, so that they knew how to cope, they knew how to fit in, they knew how to live under this very, ultimately, suppressive and imposed order. One of the things, and I found this very interesting, that Croson and Reed point out, is that the mantra of the Roman Empire was piety, especially filial piety. And that's very important because Caesars were not only considered divine, but they were the fathers of the fatherland. So this loyalty to power, this loyalty to Caesar, this filial duty, and I don't know if I'm stretching it too much to call it patriotism in our day, but it's there, it's in the roots, the patriarchy. So piety was the base of Pax Romana, followed by the necessity of war, followed by the absolute necessity of victory, and then peace. So it was that kind of a march. Duty, war,
victory,
and peace. And into that extraordinarily pervasive and strong ethic, including the use of the identical language. Paul's language, speaking of God and speaking of Jesus, was almost identical to the cult theology of Pax Romana. And so the language had to be clarified. And you see Paul struggling a lot with trying to clarify the language to people who were immersed and submerged in Pax Romana. What Paul did in carrying forward Jesus' message was hold the fact that we are in covenant, that God has made a covenant with us, and how astounding that is. It's a covenant of love. It's a covenant where God is seeking us out all of the time. And that's the base, not this filial duty or obedience, but this opening to covenant and the covenant relationship that God has with us and that we respond to. An astounding contrast to his day. He advocates nonviolence and moves deeply into that. And I heard rumors that Chad Myers just took you all out of your seats with his talk on nonviolence. You know the power of it. Justice as the basis then for peace. So that contrast is piety, war, victory to get to peace. And Paul's astounding and upsetting message of covenant, nonviolence, justice, and peace. That's our heritage. And it was so daring and threatening to the normalcy of the day. Again, Pax Romana was so pervasive that it was the definition of civilization. That was what was normal. And aren't we asked all the time to shake what we consider normal and plug it into this truly new word, new life, gospel of covenant, nonviolence, justice, and peace. I was also grateful that Michael Cosby emphasized the activism that goes with peacemakers, that it's not a passive kind of activity. And that personally makes me a little nervous. I think I'm just now, I'm holding Eleanor Roosevelt as kind of an icon for me. I just turned 60. She really got going at 62. And I'm kind of realizing that I'm moving into that activist phase in my own life, and I'll probably scare my family to death with it. But there is that activism, and I had to laugh. I picked up another book. I had it in my collection of dog-eared books by Jim Forrest, who writes a book called The Ladder of the Beatitudes. And he says, among the things that Christ did not say in the Sermon on the Mount is, blessed are those who prefer peace, wish for peace, await peace, love peace, or praise peace. Well, that's me. And I wish, I think probably many of you aspire to that more activist role where peace is about engaging the disorder that comes from dysfunctional social systems and creating order out of that disorder. I also appreciated Cosby taking us to where it happens in our household. And for me, when I read him, I kept going back and forth, kind of like an accordion, you know, narrow, oh dear, I've got to get my relationship straight with my brother. And then I'd move it out and no, it's the household in my community of church. No, it's my household of just faith. No, it's my, you know, and I keep finding myself wanting to expand that notion of household and then bringing it back in and then out and in. But he points out that household was a collection of persons and resources, and that one of those necessary ingredients was to know one another, Well, obviously, we can't know each other if we can't listen to one another. And so I'm thinking, oh yes, here's that voice of the voiceless piece. But the part that got me excited was he also named that there were the resources in the community. And we forget that in early Christian church, perhaps, those resources were shared. And that we need to sort of tweak that voice of the voiceless to also become resource for the resourceless. He also spoke in terms of community as being a much more egalitarian phenomenon. And again, this in the context of Pax Romana, where it was very, very stratified, and a lot of patronage systems and orders within the society. And here is this very egalitarian community in the early church that, oh, this is just beautiful. Seeing God as Father then connects each one of us to be brothers and sisters. And he spoke of that quasi-family. But that's real. I had an experience. I thought the strangest thing I'd ever do in life and I would never do would go to Africa. And all of a sudden I found myself heading off there, which was a bit of a surprise to me. And so I thought, oh, this is, I'm going to feel like, you know, so strange. And it's going to be very, very uncomfortable. I arrived at Entebbe, and the only association I had of Entebbe was when the Israelis were kidnapped, and there was a commando raid to free them. So this point of extraordinary violence, and of course Idi Amin, and I step onto the tarmac, and I'm at home. And I didn't understand that feeling at all. And it mystified me the whole time I was there. And one kind woman came up to me. I guess I had a particular look of consternation. And she said, "Can I help?" And I said, "Well, I don't know." I said, "I'm trying to figure out why I feel so at home here." And she looked at me with this great, big, wonderful African smile. She said, "Oh, that's easy. We're all God's children." Of course. Of course. So that quasi-family is, I don't know that I want to use the word quasi. I think that's very, very real. I also appreciated all that Cosby went into in terms of building and creating right relationships. That we provide care and affirmation. We give it, we receive it. And there's a synergy then that's created, and I love this word, entices community. It keeps us together. 25 years for you guys. And instead of fragmenting and sending people off and straying. I think you said staying and straying, and I liked that contrast. And he talked also of how it's within that community then that trust is built and you have the freedom to change and grow. So those were just very, very important kernels to me as I look at this whole issue of peacemaking and what a huge topic that is. And I don't know about you, but I think it's a pretty discouraging and even depressing time for people who aspire to peacemaking. We just have emerged out of the bloodiest century in human history, and it looks like we're trying to have that and make it bloodier in the first 50 years of this new century. And the sadness is deep.
You move your mic up just a little bit. Okay, so you can get a little more volume. Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I know there's, okay, that's suddenly louder. I'm very sorry. So the other gift that I received fairly early on was I went on a retreat with my Franciscan brothers and sisters, and what should be the topic of our weekend meditations, but the Beatitudes. And that's part of the first handout that I have for you, where you see in that rainbow-colored covenant colored top here. I realized in that meditation that my experience of the Beatitudes, if you will, or excuse me, my experience of trying to live the Beatitudes had a whole bunch to do with kind of a circle. And so I'm really more of an artist that hasn't been trained. Visual images mean a lot to me, but the computer has helped in doing some things. So I played around with some graphics to try and convey what that felt like. So this is kind of a little meditation in process. But in my own life, I find that I kind of enter into those beatitudinal teachings through several points. It might be out of a deep mourning. And it takes me, I can either become very embittered and striking out, which I've done, or I can root myself in my faith and look for that comfort that God promises. It's part of that covenant of God with us. And I find it. And then I find that because I've known some kind of a deep comforting, that I'm better able to sort of exit out, if you will, or share out of a circle to be a comfort to others. It's always a lesson. There are times when I can be nonviolent, and there are times when I have not been nonviolent. I try always to take myself into that circle. And in thinking about this as portals that we enter, there are choice points and there are also flow points. That they are places where when you're feeling very poor in spirit, you have that choice of going deep into your life with God and then taking it out into the world. It might be that you find something that is truly an issue of justice for you, and so you kind of enter into it there, and you find some kind of fulfillment that you can then take forward and out into the world. So I feel this sort of in and out, in and out, in and out, and each time there's that inward movement, it's a strengthening movement, and I've learned a little bit more about what it is to live a beatitudinal life. I loved what was for me a litany on page 27 of our book, where he talks about, I called it the abundance in God, and Cosby talks about the reign of God. He said, today, other words, for God's reign, our God's reality, actuality, presence, dynamic, being, force, strength, existence, subsistence, truth, life, energy, and power. All of that can go into that circle that I drew from the Beatitudes. And when I read that, another gift came along via our bishop in Los Angeles, Bishop Anderson. He shared a love letter, as he described it, from St. Augustine. And I think that, too, is in the center of this circle, this discovery of God's covenant with us and our life in God. How late I came to love you, O beauty so ancient and so fresh. How late I came to love you. You were within me, yet I'd gone outside to seek you. Unlovely myself, I rushed toward all those lovely things you had made. And always you were with me. I was not with you. All these beauties kept me far from you, although they would not have existed at all unless they had had their being in you. You called, you cried, you shattered my deafness. You sparkled, you blazed, you drove away my blindness. You shed your fragrance, and I drew in my breath, and I panted for you. I tasted, and now I hunger and thirst. You touched me, and now I burn with longing for your peace. That's beatitudinal living.
Who wrote that again?
St. Augustine. I get confused between Augustine and Augustine. Well, another gift that came to me was a poster that's in my office at La Casa, and it was Gandhi's Deadly Social Sins. And for me, that became yet one more way of looking into this whole phenomenon of peacemaking. Gandhi's very favorite passage out of our scripture was the Sermon on the Mount, was Beatitudes. And he led a beatitudinal life, even though he always stayed true to his Hindu roots. So I thought, okay, what did Gandhi have to say in terms of peacemaking? And I kind of reversed Gandhi, if you can forgive me a little bit, because what these seven deadly social sins tell me is that these are the arenas of peacemaking. This is where we are to be active. It's a broad base. And these hint at the kinds of questions that we need to be asking in pursuit of a just peace. What principles are embodied in our politics? Is the question that arises from that first sin, politics without principles. What is the nature of efforts or of work that underlie wealth? Are people cheating and lying and faking financial reports, etc., in order to build wealth? Or are they in there creating work for people, treating employees well, and bringing about prosperity from the grassroots? What moral codes govern our business activities? I did an interesting little Google search one time on human rights and the business world, and right now they're kind of embracing a couple of them. That's it. They don't warm readily to human rights language. What sensitivities and insights are developed through pleasure? God certainly has given us a world in which we can delight, and you heard it in Augustine, you know, a very earthy relationship, tasting and feeling and seeing. But what are those lessons that we're learning from pleasure? Some of them can increase our sensitivities and insights, and others deaden and demean and destroy. What character-building skills are being taught in our schools? I read somewhere that the university first meant taking care of the soul. Boy, do we do that now, university people? And what services to humanity and creation are being rendered by our sciences? I love the work that's being done in LED lighting to try and take off-the-grid lighting to Africa. That's an incredible good use of science. Atomic weaponry, better radio communications so that we can zap people 250,000 miles away. I don't know. To me, that is abhorrent. That's not a responsible and reliable use of science. And what purposeful self-denials and sacrifices are pursued in worship and our religious institutions that prepare us to find and serve the holy in each person? I think these are questions that some will be more powerful to you, others will be less so, but I think these are questions that the Spirit can move within you as you begin to identify where in this broad, broad, broad world of peacemaking you need to focus or want to focus your efforts or being guided to focus your efforts. Then a friend, and maybe some of you know Ernie Tuminga from the Goleta Presbyterian Church. He's a Teilhard scholar. I see some heads nodding. He called one day and was really wanting to do some retreats out at La Casa, and we were talking about Earth Day. Ernie didn't know this. And he started talking about Teilhard and how he wanted to do the Mass on the world. I wasn't familiar with this at all, and so I didn't want to be totally ignorant in talking to Ernie. And got Teilhard's book. And this next quote is from his Mass on the World, and I think is probably the yearning that is there deep, deep within us, deep within all of us, that is the peacemaker's prayer. In the very depths of this formless Mass, you, God, have implanted, and this I'm sure of, for I sense it, a desire, irresistible, hollowing, which makes us cry out, believer and unbeliever alike, Lord, make us one. And I told you I'm more of a visual person than a word person, even though I'm speaking a lot of words up here. I was bopping around trying to come up with some images for a Just Faith initial prayer, and we were using Francis's prayer, Song of Creation. Now, how am I going to put Brother Sun on the altar and have a lovely prayer today? Well, I'll bet there's some interesting images out on the internet. So I go out, and I'm getting so excited that I can sit at this machine. Talk about good use of science. And with a few keystrokes, I can look into our solar system. And my son was there, and I was getting increasingly upside, you know, very, very excited. I was kind of dancing around and thinking, this is great, this is great, this is great. My son says, Mom, have you seen the deep space shot from the Hubble telescope? I said, well, I knew about the Hubble telescope, but now I hadn't seen it. He said, well, before I show it to you, I want you to know that what they did was they focused the telescope on a part of space that was an absolute void to the naked eye. Nothing was there. And they took time-lapse photography, and at the bottom of this page is a picture of deep space. And there's at least six galaxies in there. Well, forget about Rhapsody. I moved into an awe, and it just was something I, to this day, can't really give words to. But I realized that there are vistas that are unfolding all of the time. That is God's work in this world. And for me, this is kind of that icon of this unfolding. We can't imagine all the ways that peace is going to come about. We simply can't. It's something that's going to be unfolding well beyond our lifetime. But I think it has something to do with that phenomenal creative God that we love. I know it has something to do. And then this is also sort of an image of our small knowing. There's something about the spiritual life where we need to be holding in reverence our unknowing, and at the same time honoring our small knowing and recognizing it. That, I think, is part of what underlies dialogue, is that we can go in and we can feel like we've got quite a few answers, and then we get into dialogue and we start expanding the universe of perspectives, and you come out of that experience richer. So those were the inspirations that brought me to today. Then I thought, well, are they going to be expecting any kind of help? Somebody who's just starting in activism. Well, that second handout I thought might be helpful. It's been helpful to me. It's something I developed when I was working on my thesis on forgiveness. And I was taking a look at what are seen as sort of customary ways of handling conflict and power struggles. And on that first diagram, it moves from avoidance to violent action. And one of the things I'm now appreciating about this, I've been living with this continuum quite some time, is that that was taught at the universities. And if you note in the green, I've kind of put a meeting point between the two continuum because I couldn't stretch this all out as one continuum. But Elise Boulding talks about the peacemaking activities. And these don't get into our academic books about how to resolve conflict. And I found that disturbing. We need to somehow gain a lot more information and a lot more tools, if you will, of how it is that peacemakers go about making peace. And for me, an advantage of a continuum is that it honors what happens with our small knowledge, and that is we kind of close down. We can't really imagine alternatives. And this kind of a continuum sort of expands the universe of possibilities. And whenever I'm troubled with a situation, I try to place a particular conflict or power struggle, somewhere on that continuum, knowing that you don't all of a sudden move to union just out of good intentions, that you have to take the small steps. For me, the scary part of this continuum is where legal procedures, courts, laws, authoritative decision-making rest. It's very close to war. It's our substitute for. That's what we're trying to get established, is the rule of law. But look where that is in terms of the broader universe of opportunities. And for those who get entrapped in legal cases, you know how quickly the language is battle and winning and losing, and a very punitive and retributive justice gets in. And if you move down towards those middle zones where there's mutual adaptation, which I like better than problem solving, I think what happens in problem solving is there is a mutual adaptation happening, reconciliation. You move from forgiveness to that hard work of reconciliation where you see people truly as another child of God and can truly put the past to rest. To active cooperation, to integration, and then to union. So there's this whole realm of peacemaking strategies where I think most of us don't have skills. It doesn't fit into our culture too easily. Mediation is a profession that is struggling to get established. We almost think it's foolish not to have that lawyer out there arguing our case. We can't be resolving our conflicts with the help of a skilled mediator. What are we doing? So it helps me kind of move into my society, know where it is I want to work, where I would like to put my efforts, and where I want to try to resolve my own conflicts in my own life, and then as I move into this activist realm, where I hope I will be joining groups somewhere in this continuum that's not on the violent end, but more on that peacemaking end. And on the back of this, oh, I did want to make one other point. I didn't take my little additional things that kept coming my way. Again, out of the search for Paul, Croson and Reed point out that when we're talking of God's righteousness and God's justice, we're not talking about punitive justice. That's very much a human invention put onto God. When we talk justice, we talk punishment. When God empowers justice, it's a distributive justice. It's about that egalitarianism again, about evening out the burdens in life, about providing the resources for the resourceless. It's a very different image of justice. To have a distributive justice versus a punitive justice. I thought, well, that's kind of esoteric. Why should I bring that kind of thing up? Well, in The Economist, on March 11th, there was a special report on war crimes that told me this is indeed a very real distinction. The good news is that it's now accepted that there can be no immunity for the worst violations of human rights, not even for heads of state. The debate has long ranged about the best way to deal with gross violations of human rights. Is it more important to punish the perpetrators or to bring an end to atrocities? So here's this dichotomy that peace is going to be an end of atrocities, and oh please, but there's this, we've got to punish, and it can't be both. Well, they're struggling with it, and with Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, truly something new came into the world scene because of their work. And now, according to the Economist, we're getting to where people are beginning to hope or see that reconciliation and punitive justice are not antagonistic, but they are two approaches complementary to one another. It's a very real debate. It's very real in the world, and it's happening a lot. But the sadness in this report, to me, is that it doesn't expand the universe. It doesn't look at all of the other kinds of ways of approaching things that we can take a look at when we consider a whole continuum and how we can move from the punitive justice to other kinds of things. And still recognize that impunity is probably the biggest drag on human rights that the world has. People are literally getting away with mass murder, and that can't continue. On the next page, I then thought, okay, that's on the back, some practical approaches to peacemaking. This comes from a book called Just Peacemaking, 10 Practices for Abolishing War. And one thing that made me appreciate this book greatly was that the authors right up front said, this was the title chosen by our editors. We're not anywhere near proclaiming that we can abolish war. I liked that integrity. Great. They've separated out the marketing from the reality. But what these authors did was to take a look at what actually worked. I'm enough of a cynic to think that there's very little that can be done in the midst of horrific violence. That there aren't very many cures. The harm and the angst and the bitterness and the pain and the anguish that's flowing out of those times are going to take decades and centuries to heal. So I tend to find my hope in what are things that are preventable strategies. What are the kinds of things that we can do to try to move that on that continuum closer and closer to peacemaking? And that's the question these gentlemen asked. And one of the things that they suggested in terms of peacemaking initiatives is to support and or participate in nonviolent direct action. We have an example in our own society of Martin Luther King's movement, the whole civil rights movement. And we may have something emerging right out of the Catholic Church in the Catholic Campaign for Immigration Reform. It's new. From what I understand of it, it's going to be a three-year project. You had the Archbishop of Los Angeles stand up and say he was going to order his priests to not abide by the immigration law that is being proposed and is now being considered in the Senate. That's nonviolent direct action. This is a bad law, and we're not going to cooperate with it. There is going to be a march this Saturday. I know many of you are aware of it, and I did bring a flyer. And I also have up here our website that you can go to, this one, that will share with you the reasons for concern for this law that's being proposed. It did pass the House, and the Senate will be considering it on this coming Tuesday. It is a frightening bill, but that's my feelings towards it. Another thing that you can do is give your political support to independent initiatives to reduce threat. I once had somebody define, I think it might have been in the Just Face class, that the posture of the politician is this. You know, which way is the wind blowing? We need to make our political will known so that when our leaders are taking risky actions, risky initiatives, they know that they've got the political support behind them. Politicians simply don't move out ahead of the curve very often. The example here was President Eisenhower and Kennedy unilaterally halting atmospheric testing back in 1963. That was a unilateral act. Tom Hecht is writing a screenplay right now where he's envisioning an independent act that would change the conversation. And that's what happened. Gorbachev acted independently and changed the conversation. You want to look to those leaders, and even if you have the ideas, share those ideas and begin to support what comes onto your radar screen of those things that are positive actions, risky actions, but they hold the promise of changing the conversation and getting the threat reduced. And Mary, I know you think a lot about that with the many, many threats of nuclear armament. Oscar Romero, not one of my heroes. Oscar Arias of Costa Rica. Costa Rica does not have a military. He used his Nobel Peace Prize money to establish a foundation, and they're trying to reduce the threat of small arms trade, immensely profitable trade. There's, again, somebody who's trying to change the conversation and lessen the threat. Look for cooperative conflict resolution, neighborhood justice centers, or community mediation. Consider that and support mediation, support negotiation, support those kinds of things that are, again, moving the conversation, if you will, down that continuum toward more peaceful behavior. And we need to be able to acknowledge our responsibility for conflict and injustice. That's awfully hard for Americans to do. We have a very difficult time talking about the shadow side of our culture. We aren't alone in that. Every society, I think, tries to put its very best image forward and rally the troops around that and fidelity and all of those things. But that doesn't get us very far. We do need to acknowledge responsibility for conflict and injustice, seek repentance and forgiveness. That is what the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission gave as gift to this world, and we really, really need to pay attention to it and not allow it to be dismissed as, well, it can't work anywhere else, that was a Christian country. Thank goodness it was a Christian country. Indeed, it was the Christian faith that said a great deal of that. But that's God's work. It's broader than what happened in Africa. And that's what we have to call up and point out, I think. In terms of justice, advancing democracy nonviolently, human rights, and religious liberty. They're all kind of interconnected. In Czechoslovakia, you had Havel adding pressure for democracy because he was pressing for human rights. And that dance happens all around the world, that as human rights are honored, democracy is flourishing. As human rights are suppressed, democracy is dies or doesn't exist at all. Very good to look for ways that you can foster just and sustainable economic development. The Grameen-style bank, and Mary and Gary are very active with Francoise in Haiti. The microdevelopment financing of development is important. I put the website for the UN Millennium Development Goals. Very important to be aware of those. And if you don't like writing reports, it's a 386-page report. Don't go there unless you want to be an expert. There is a smaller report called an overview that I think is about 50 pages I have with me. And then there's a readable book, End of Poverty by Jeffrey Sachs, that you might want to take a look at. That the Millennium Development Goals, I think, at least my impression is that it's one of the very best things to come out of the UN ever. And you might look for ways that you can support various endeavors. It's a very broad based program or report. How am I doing on time?
We're at break time.
So 5 minutes? But am I about there?
Yeah,
okay.
No, because
I'm really within that 5 minutes. So. And then in terms of love and community, be on the lookout for those cooperative forces in the international system. I adapted this to try and relate to things that you would be most interested in, and as an Episcopalian in just faith, I've been hearing more about. But you do have Catholic Relief Services. I would urge that you look for ways to strengthen the UN, including UN reform, and any international efforts that cooperate across regions and for human rights enforcement. The European Court of Human Rights has been quite successful, and the International Criminal Court is having its impact. And it's cited in that Economist article. It's not having the power that it needs, but given the power it has, it's having quite an impact. Look for ways of reducing offensive weapons and weapons trade. Chilling statistics there, but the hope would be that if we could ever redirect 25% of our military funds for 10 years, we could meet the Millennium Development Goals. Political will. And then locally, encourage grassroots peacemaking groups and voluntary associations. Two that I'm familiar with are Pueblo and Clergy and Laity United for Economic Justice. So there are things within our community you can be on the lookout for. Well, in closing, the other guest that came to me, I don't know how many of you are familiar with the name of Parker Palmer, but I kind of love him because he wrote a book called The Active Life. I can relate to that. And he was in Santa Barbara in January and shared with us a booklet called The Politics of the Brokenhearted, which is a fine essay. And I would encourage you to go to Fester here and request this. It's available free. You go to Fester.org and hit resources, and I think it's about page 2. They have lots and lots of wonderful essays. This is in a series called Essays on Deepening the American Dream. But I think this says so much. We can be peacemakers in our small part of the world only when we have peace within ourselves. Finding inner peace requires us to hold perhaps the most subtle and yet most difficult tension of all, the tension between reality and possibility. I have come to think of this as standing in the tragic gap, the gap between our knowledge of what is and our knowledge of what might be. If we find ourselves unable to stand in that place, we will be pulled to one side or the other, toward the paralyzing cynicism that too much reality can breed, or toward the wistful and irrelevant idealism that is bred by too much possibility. The gap between what is and what might be is tragic, not simply because it's sad. It is tragic because, in the classic sense of the word, it is the inevitable outcome of the flawed nature of human life. Name anyone famous for a devotion to justice and peace, and you will find people who came to trust, not resist, the journey of heartbreak described by the Sufi master Khan. God breaks the heart again and again and again until it stays open. Thank you.